Penguin Random House Audio presents Motherland, a memoir of love, loathing, and longing. This is the author, Alyssa Altman. From my mother, now and always. So close to the end of my childbearing life without children, if I could remember a day when I was utterly a girl and not yet a woman. But I don't think there was a day like that for me. When I look at the girl I was, dripping in her bathing suit or riding her bike, pumping hard down the newly paved street, she wears a furtive look. And even if I could go back in time to her as me, the age I am now, she would never come into my arms without believing that I wanted something. Marie Howe, the girl. Mother. 1. A. A female parent. B. A woman in higher authority, specifically, the superior of a religious community of women. 2. An older or elderly woman. 3. Source, origin. 4. Maternal tenderness or affection. 5. Vulgar. 6. Something that is an extreme or ultimate example of its kind, specifically in terms of scale, the mother of all projects. 7. Vinegar or sourdough starter. Also, mother sauce, mother tongue, mother board, mother ship, mother load, mother love, motherfucker. Preface. I was born with a small irregular spot on my fifth rib, beneath my left breast and below the ventricular arrhythmic tip of my heart. The color of a faint lavender bruise, it is shaped like a triangle, a nick in a piece of old furniture. "You were supposed to be a twin," my father said. "That's probably all that's left of her." He told me this over a pastrami sandwich at our local delicatessen in Forest Hills, New York, where we lived in a brick apartment building the color of a pencil eraser. It was the early 70s, and I was a young child, still in single digits. The air between us was humid with sauerkraut and celery fumes, and I placed my hand over the mark and closed my eyes. I imagined who she might have been and what she might have looked like. I swore to protect her in a way I can only now describe as maternal. As a child, I wore this mark like a badge of unfulfilled promise. I believed that she, this disfigurement, was the one I was supposed to be, the one who could have made my mother happy and eased her yearning. Motherland. Part 1. Love doesn't just sit there like a stone. It has to be made. Like bread, remade all the time, made new. Ursula K. Le Guin, The Lathe of Heaven. Chapter 1. My Connecticut kitchen in the early morning. My wife and I live where it is quiet, not quite rural, not quite suburban, where a car driving down the street in the middle of the day is cause for wonder, and, because I am still a New Yorker at heart, for the locking of the front door. Recently, we bought a heavy-duty deadbolt. We'd never had one. Because the previous owner, who built our little house on an acre in 1971, had installed a simple push-button bedroom lock on the hollow-core front door. It wasn't that he was cheap. There was just no reason to have anything more secure. He didn't want to court karmic trouble by kitting out his home like Fort Knox. He was safe here, he told us, with his wife and two growing daughters. When Susan and I came to look at the house on a snowy February afternoon in 2004, the owner, in his late 80s and wearing a black and red wool hunting coat and a green camouflage knit cap, leaned his wooden cane against one of the front pillars, pulled a massive gas-powered snowblower out of the garage, and carved a wide path for us to safely walk side by side around the property. He apologized for the state of his beloved rhododendrons and azaleas, which had recently been devoured by deer, but were nonetheless neatly wrapped up like cigars from top to bottom in garden burlap, as if to protect the possibility that they might flower again when the season changed. Gardening is a contract with hope. The man's wife, a laconic blue-eyed woman just beginning to forget, gave us a swatch of the original yellow and silver-striped wallpaper, in case we ever needed to match it. They had led a good life here, the man said, and were downsizing to a nearby retirement community. One daughter was moving to England, and the other to a small village in the Berkshire foothills. They were proud of their home, but soft-spoken and humble in the way Yankees tend to be. Except for removing the wallpaper, we touched nothing else for years, including the girls' bedrooms, whose walls still bore the vinyl-flowered adhesive evidence of their childhood. We eventually turned one room into my office and the other into a book-lined guest room that I envisioned someday containing a simple shaker-style crib, a rocking chair, a changing table. We even took chances with the lock until I began to work from home. Susan and I had thrown caution to the wind because security and safety can be such a myth. Trouble can come from anywhere. In the years that Susan and I have been in this house, I have learned the seasonal trajectory of light, which in the morning streams through the dining room window onto our ancient barnwood table in one harsh bolt. By sundown, it glares through the living room in an explosion so bright that it's often hard to see the house across the street. Our life here is slow and quiet, and for two women together 19 years, conventional. My work is solitary. When I'm writing, I can sit at my desk and not get up for hours until the sun has made its circle around the house. A clock isn't necessary. I know what time it is by the cast of light on the walls. On this day, the sun isn't all the way up, and the interior of the house is a murky gray. I have just come in from a run. I was never a runner, but I began recently because it creates a kind of porosity. It allows air and light to filter through me and loosens the knot that snares me every morning before 8 when I answer the phone in the slim moment between the ring and the sound of my mother's voice. A rest. A beat. A break in the symbiosis that has defined us and the universe in which we've lived. I stand in my kitchen and stare at the phone. I inhale. It rings. The dog barks. I exhale. I choose my response. The seconds between stimulus and reaction, Viktor Frankl called it, in which lies my freedom. Like the Centralia mine fire, my mother and I have been burning for half a century. We draw life from the heart of battle, a dopamine helix that propels us forward, breathing air into our days like a bellows. Some Buddhists say that anger is good when it is generative. If so, the warring to which we are addicted has enlivened us and built up our muscle memory like the hands of a boxer. We bob and weave. We love and we loathe, we shout and whisper, and the next morning we do it all over again. Like tying our shoes or brushing our teeth or shaving one leg before the other, this is our ritual, our habit. We know no other way. What is your intoxicant of choice? I was once asked at an AA meeting. I sat on a rusting beige metal folding chair in the basement of a white clapboard congregational church in rural Connecticut, drinking cold coffee out of a styrofoam cup. Wine? Scotch? Beer before breakfast? Shopping? Porn? My mother, I whispered. People shifted. They held their chins. My mother. Lead a simple life, a neurologist advises Joan Didion in the White Album, when she begins in middle age to suffer from a nervous disorder with symptoms she describes as being usually associated with telethons. Not that it makes any difference we know about, the doctor adds. Leading a simple life may be nothing more than placebo.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?